X-Talks connects professionals in the life science, medical device, and food industries with useful content like webinars, job openings, articles, and virtual meetings to help you succeed in your career. This Life Science Focus podcast brings together some of our editorial staff to share insights into the latest B2B industry news to keep you up to date.
Hello and welcome to the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. I'm Aisha Rashid, Senior Life Science Journalist at xtalks.com, and this week I'm delighted to introduce some very special guests on the show. Today we have with us Dr. Tania Camphouse and Tony Viliotti, who will speak about new research that shows liver disease can be diagnosed using non-invasive blood tests that could help patients avoid costly, painful, and dangerous liver biopsies for disease diagnosis. And this news is particularly timely because the American Diabetes Association recently called for liver disease screening for all adults with type 2 diabetes. And so the new research published in Nature Medicine presents results from a study that evaluated blood-based biomarker tests for the diagnosis of non-alcoholic steatohepatitis or NASH. The study's co-author, Dr. Tania Camphouse, who is the Director of Translational Science, Metabolic Disorders, as well as Director of Patient Engagement at the Foundation for the National Institutes of Health, or FNIH, will speak to us about the study results and also what we can expect from these non-invasive tests, when they may become the standard of care for liver disease diagnosis, and the ongoing work her group is doing in the area. Also, we have with us, as I mentioned, Tony Viliotti, who is the founder of the nonprofit NASH Knowledge, as well as a patient whose NASH led to liver cancer and subsequent liver transplant. He will speak about the impact that this research will have on the patient community. Tony believes that his liver cancer could have been prevented had a non-invasive test for NASH been available to him. To hear more about the latest research in the area of liver disease and about blood-based biomarker testing, let's turn to our guests. Welcome to the show, Dr. Camphouse and Tony. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Aisha, for having us over. It's really exciting to have this conversation and share with you some of the latest work that we've been doing to make diagnostic tests available for patients early on so they do not have to go through liver biopsies.
Absolutely. Likewise, I'm very excited to learn more about the latest advancements in the field and about your research that could definitely help patients in terms of having greater access and flexibility and through non-invasive tests. So thank you so much once again to the both of you for being here. And first off, I'd like to ask more about liver disease, specifically non-alcoholic fatty liver disease or NAFLD, and the progression to a subset called NASH, which is, of course, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. So could you tell us a bit more about these conditions?
Sure. So non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or NAFLD, affects about 30 million people globally. So it's a very, very prevalent disease, fairly undetectable on the face of it. So early detection is important. Now, about 15 million people in the United States that have NAFLD will eventually progress to NASH. This is a progressively worsening disease that is marked by inflammation and scarring of the liver. So your liver stops functioning as well as it should. And in many cases, it can quickly deteriorate to a cirrhosis. Now, typically when we hear cirrhosis, we associate it with consumption of alcohol and liver injury from that. But as the name suggests, non-alcoholic liver disease is really caused due to metabolic factors, and metabolic factors like diabetes or obesity that are frequently associated with worsening functions of many of your internal organs, heart, kidney, liver, everything tends to function poorly. And in the case of the liver, that disease is called NAFLD, and then it progresses to NASH, as we just talked about. And so it's really critically important for us to be able to find that population that is likely going to progress to NASH and intervene early on, so they don't have to go through the very difficult process of living with NASH or going through liver transplants or developing cancer. So this is really the purpose of our work here, is to identify that population that we'll call at risk of progression, and how do we quickly identify it in a non-invasive manner, so we can then find ways to manage and treat that population and serve them.
Very, very important. And so before we get more into the research around these diagnostic tests, I'd like to actually ask, what have the unmet needs been in NASH? And I'd really like to hear both, of course, from a research medical perspective, as well as a patient perspective from yourself as well, Tony.
Yeah, if I could start off, in terms of unmet needs, the thing about non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is if you catch it early, it can be reversed through lifestyle changes. So the unmet need is the ability to first to diagnose the disease at the earliest possible point, and then to monitor the progression of the disease over time. And that's something I know in my case was completely absent. I went from having no concerns about my liver, just being told I had a fatty liver, to having cirrhosis. Mm-hmm. And with the availability of these non-invasive biomarkers, I feel that I could have known earlier the potential for how serious the disease could be, and could have done something about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The awareness, as Tony said, right, of the fact that this can progress to very serious outcomes. There are not really any drugs that can treat them. It's a real motivator for lifestyle changes if it's caught early. And also, if we can identify that population, then it's an easier way for drug developers to build new treatment options, because you have to isolate your population that you're going to include in a clinical study. And so there's two reasons why this is so important. One is just early diagnosis, healthcare management, and there's a lot of people who are living with NAFLD at risk of progressing to NASH. So it would be really helpful to have an easily accessible, non-invasive way to detect that and confirm that it is, in fact, with some precision, that it is the disease you have. And then the second is, if we can then, people who have new treatment options and want to test it out in different populations, can recruit from diverse populations easily enough into a clinical study that they can power to see how their intervention or their treatment that they're trying to bring to market is behaving, and is it helping reverse the course of the disease or not. So there's many uses, but we can't move forward if we are hampered by getting a liver biopsy as a first step to enter into any of these.
Could you tell us more about your latest research, Dr. Camphouse, published by your group in Nature Medicine, about using blood-based biomarkers for diagnosing NASH through a simple diagnostic test, and what sorts of biomarkers are in these panels that you looked at, and how early can you diagnose NASH?
Right. So the project that this result has come from is run by the Foundation for the National Institutes of Health, where I work, and is under the auspices of Biomarkers Consortium. Now, it's an organization within FNIH that manages and studies programs related to biomarker development and qualification with the FDA. So it's a huge huge innovation in our space would be if we could meet the regulatory hurdles of qualifying biomarkers and getting them to a place where everybody can use those biomarkers in their studies and for use in diagnosis or prognosis of disease. So the NIMBLE project, which is what the project is called, is NIMBLE stands for Non-Invasive Biomarkers of Metabolic Liver Disease, is really designed not really to discover new biomarkers. There are lots of research happening in this space, but we're very focused on those biomarkers that have a lot of current evidence based on research that has been done by those companies that have developed these biomarker panels, but really to confirm the accuracy of these biomarkers and compare them to existing blood-based tests. Now, none of those tests are approved either, but there are indicators of somebody potentially having fatty liver, but we can't use them very effectively to stage the disease and therefore, you know, figure out where you need to intervene. But we wanted to make sure that whatever we were developing would perform better than what is already available for free in the market. It doesn't make any sense to do any more work. So our goal was we picked five test panels, and these were picked because they had the most evidence in the field at that time published that they perform really well. Now remember, we are all anchored to the biopsy as our reference standard, which itself has some challenges. So we can discuss that later. But that's really, so anchored to the biopsy, you know, how did these biomarkers perform to diagnose people at risk of NASH or the isolating the population that really need intervention? And so that was really our goal. And we wanted to make sure that this work was aligned with our colleagues at FDA who are working on qualification. And so we took input from our colleagues at FDA when we designed the letter of intent for how these biomarkers could potentially be qualified, and had several iterative conversations in this space. So this is the goal and the innovation of the program is to bring existing biomarkers to deploy them in a setting, right? So we were generating evidence for that. So we looked at a little over 1,000 patients who had biopsies collected very close to the blood sample that was collected. So they were within a window of time because we wanted to make sure that these things were tightly related. And then we used those tubes of blood from these patients to test four or five different biomarkers. And so they were tested on the same set of patients. The companies that built those tests ran them, and then they send the raw data back. And centrally, we pulled all of that together along with what the fibrosis stage or the NASH stage of those patients was, just to see if these biomarkers are able to predict that NASH stage, and if they are able to perform better than the current standards, right? So that was really the design of our study. And what we thought was really important as a study to make sure that we had every fibrosis stage. So let me take a step back and describe that, you know, when you have NAFLD, you have inflammation and you have fibrosis. Mm-hmm. And your liver goes through fibrosis, and we sort of want, you know, it's sort of a ordinal qualifications. We have F0, no fibrosis, F1, F2, F3, F4, and that's then cirrhosis. And so we wanted to make sure that any progression of fibrosis and any progression of therefore liver health could be tracked by these biomarkers. So we wanted, so of the 1,000 people we picked, it was well distributed across each fibrosis stage just to see how those biomarkers were performing for that particular fibrosis stage. So this, what we thought, was very important part of the study because it gave us really sort of rigorous look into the how well the biomarkers performed. So the good news is that at least four of those biomarkers did really well at and outperformed the existing fibrosis biomarker, which is Fib4, and the inflammation biomarker, which is ALT, and they did really well. And there are some biomarkers that performed really well at the earlier inflammation stage, and then some biomarkers have performed really well at the fibrosis stage, which also gives us a look into sort of what biological underpinnings these biomarkers are able to detect. So it was a gratifying result. It was fairly robust. The statistical plan was built a priori, which means before the study was even initiated, the statistical plan was locked down. The nimble team only got final set of data to evaluate. It was done independently. The evaluation was done independently. The tests were done in different labs. And so it was really, the task really was to sort of coordinate all of this effort as it was mm-hmm. happening, making sure that there was no contamination of information, there's influence of, across the various 30 partners that are part of the Nimble project, and that we were all pushing towards the same end goal. And so when we finally got the result, it was very exciting to see that, in fact, there were these biomarkers that performed so well. And now it's confirmed mm-hmm. that they do perform well and are sort of anchored into the biopsy.
Excellent. And so how far are these tests from being used in the clinic? And in your opinion, are they ready to completely replace something like a liver biopsy? Or are we still looking at using these tests in conjunction with other tests? Or can they one day be used on their own, which is obviously the goal, right?
You know, it's a good question. And it's one that I know that Tony, more than I, has been waiting to hear the answer to. Mm-hmm. The challenge is that up until now, even though biopsy is a fairly imperfect standard, that is the reference standard we have.
Right.
And the only thing that would be, better than that in our conversations with regulators and patients is to see, what can you connect the performance of these biomarkers, or if they predict, with certain probability that you're going to progress through NASH and get cirrhosis, but could we link those outcomes, meaning, do you have, what kind of liver damage can those patients have with the start of the, earlier on the process, which means that you have to design an observational outcome study,
right,
which is a 10, 15 year study with, a significant population follow-up to happen for us to really connect this to the outcome, connect the biomarkers and the biopsy to the outcome. And that would be the best way for us to completely replace the biopsy, is to connect the biomarkers mm-hmm. to the outcome. And then we're also working on that, right? So we're also working on looking at how can we move away completely from the biopsy. But for that to happen, we have to sort of build the evidence base for the biopsy and the outcomes. So that would be the ultimate goal. In terms of our sort of more immediate next step, where we would love to get to is, for the foundation and for Nimble, our immediate next step is, could we qualify these biomarker panels with the FDA? And what that means is, we work in a pre-competitive space, so we don't really, looking to promote one biomarker panel over another, but what we are saying is this panel is indicative of this disease, right? This disease progression. So it's based in biology, and we just have to sort of put together the evidence necessary to convince the regulators that it is in fact the case. And then once we have done that, and we're in the process of putting together several qualification plans as a result of this work, then the regulators can tell us yes or no, and in what category. So mm-hmm. at this point in time, what we've heard is, your biomarkers are really good to enrich populations before they get biopsied. So we still need a biopsy, but the screen failure rate, so if you do biopsy of 10 people, you can maybe, three people will be at risk, even though you're looking at a enriched population. So if now think about, you did blood test on all 10, and you forwarded 5, and of those, only 3 had to undergo, could move forward. Now you're concentrating and you're reducing the burden on the population, right, and on everybody else to get biopsies done. This would itself be a huge move,
yes,
in the right direction, because the screen failure rate has really plagued us for a long time in drug development. But if you can also use this blood-based biomarker as a diagnostic kit, then, you don't really need to have, you can get confirmed with biopsy, but you can have an easily accessible diagnostic kit, right? So that work, I think each one of the companies that is building, has built this and has shared their kits with us and essentially allowed us to independently validate the results, will have access to the data that's been generated as part of the public-private partnership to then put in applications to get their kits approved with the FDA and the EMA. So that's really our goal, is sort of, rising tide floats all boats. And so we're hoping that the result that's underpinning this paper can be used in many different ways.
Excellent. And so the idea then would be to identify at-risk populations or at-risk individuals and to monitor potentially their, or to monitor their risk for the potential development of NASH. And so once you've identified those patients, would you be using the same test or other tests to monitor their progression potentially?
I think that's a great question, and we do not have that data yet, right? Mm-hmm. Like what we don't really know if these biomarkers are going to also be able to tell us about progression, right? Like they can also read progression. We know that they can diagnose, and so they have this enormous applicability,
which is huge to identify those outcomes.
But then progression of the disease is another piece that would be really critical to have, just because everybody who has NAFLD doesn't develop NASH.
Right.
Everybody who has NASH, much more likely to progress, but not everybody progresses. So it will be really good to identify the population that really needs intervention, so we are not unnecessarily, treating people when they don't need to be or can get lifestyle modification. So I think it would be, those are the sort of the immediate next steps for us, are to look into these areas and see how we can utilize these biomarkers in a few different settings.
Right.
But most immediately, I think the fact that we can use it as a diagnostic enrichment biomarker, in the sort of drug development speak, I think that would be ideal for drug development. But
yes,
availability of these tests after they're approved for diagnosis would be huge.
Huge, exactly. And so, Tony, I'd like to ask, having gone through this journey, what were some of the barriers when you look back in terms of reaching your diagnosis and getting to where you are today, and how some of those could be overcome with a non-invasive test? And when you reflect back, how do you see that? And what do you think, and have things improved today in terms of trying to eliminate those kinds of barriers through, of course, on the scientific side, on, through tests like this that might become available, as well as increasing awareness around the disease itself?
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, from the patient perspective, the biggest barrier right now is lack of awareness and lack of education about the liver. You hear a lot about type 2 diabetes, hear a lot about obesity, but liver health really takes a back seat.
Right.
And there have been studies that show that less than 10% of the people that have a fatty liver know that they have it. So there's this large pool of people sitting out there who don't, who are at risk and don't know it. And so that's a major barrier. And so I think one thing that needs to be addressed is how to make these people aware. And that's one thing we try to do with our nonprofit. But in my situation, I was told I had a fatty liver based on liver enzymes, and I continued to see my doctor over a 9-year period, because I was a type 2 diabetic. And sometimes he talked about fatty liver, sometimes he didn't. Then an appointment after 9 years, he tells me I have NASH, which I never heard of at the time. Mm-hmm. And I probably had cirrhosis. So I went from, kind of 0 to 60, not thinking I had a problem, all of a sudden having a major problem. Now, if at you know, when this was happening to me, you know, some of the tests that Tanya described were not available. And, you know, and if I had known earlier, you know, through the use of these tests, that I was at risk, for having NASH and, you know, going beyond that, I would have made, you know, changes in my lifestyle. You know, my wife would have enforced those changes on me. You know, and you know, I think, you know, a lot of my issues could have been avoided. So this is a major step forward in my mind. You know, these tests are available now, but I think, you know, having this discussion with the FDA and having in effect a stamp of approval, I think will increase the use of those tests. And, you know, and that will be, from a patient perspective, that'll be very helpful, because I think that will result in, you know, more doctors and clinicians using the non-invasive test. People just do not like to get biopsies. You know, there's a, even though the risk is minor, there is a risk, and it's very disruptive in a sense. Mm-hmm. You have to go to a hospital, and, you know, someone has to come with you, and so it's very disruptive. And so, you know, whereas the non-invasive test, you know, the blood tests are, you know, can be done just with a, you know, draw of blood, and some of the others can be done in a doctor's office. And so I think that will result in a lot more people undergoing testing. So this is a big deal. I mean, you know, when one of the things we do in our organization, we have a support group that has over 200 people in it with liver disease, and mm-hmm. non-invasive testing is something that's very much in the forefront of their minds. They love, you know, they love the non-invasive tests and would love not having to undergo a biopsy to participate in trials and that kind of thing.
And Aisha, one more thing that just to add, you know, I just want to also applaud Tony, because, you know, what you mentioned at the open was, you know, how ADA now has a guidance for liver screening, right? This comes because of the advocacy of our patients. Mm-hmm. They, you know, because you have to raise awareness. If you have other metabolic factors, you should get screened for, you know, NAFLD and NASH and other conditions. And we just, that lack of awareness that Tony and others are trying to bridge, I think it's very critical. But now we have this, a little, you know, tool for us to, how mm-hmm. do you scan? How do you screen, right? So the first is just the policy change or the guidance. And then,
which is huge in itself.
Very huge. And it takes years and a dedicated effort of so many people. But then now we can offer a tool, right?
Yep.
And that hopefully will take us to the next stage where people are going to both know that they need to get tested. So there isn't a surprise, you know, after 9 years of going to a doctor that you have a serious liver condition that, so that would have been completely avoidable, I think, and hopefully would be in the future.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think pairing that awareness with early diagnosis, I think that relationship definitely, you know, has to be built. And it's great to see how patients and clinicians, you know, can make that happen together.
Yeah, you know, one thing I'd like to add too is there's a lot going on, with non-invasive testing. You know, there's new tests being developed all the time. And one of the side benefits of this whole process is it provides a roadmap for how to qualify, you know, additional tests down the road. Right. So, you know, I think it just kind of opens up the field to end up with a lot better situation for patients.
Definitely. And I think I would, you know, think that from the clinician side, it would be easier to manage patients as well. Clinicians might even hesitate in the past to refer their patients for something as invasive as a liver biopsy. But if you have a test available, and patients may hesitate, and, you know, so there's that barrier as well. So this definitely, I think, a non-invasive test is huge in eliminating just testing barriers, I think, as well. So this is really excellent to learn about. And I think, Dr. Camphouse, as you mentioned, that the work of advocacy groups and patients like Tony, I think incorporating that patient voice and it is important really in increasing awareness about the disease and bringing about these kinds of policy changes that we've seen recently with the American Diabetes Association. So that's really excellent. And so how is the patient voice being incorporated in research from both of your perspectives?
Do you want me to go first, Tony?
Yes, please.
Okay. The patient voice, first of all, we tend to think of patient voice as a singular entity, which it is not, because mm-hmm. patients are as diverse as people, we just have to make sure that we are listening to a lot of different folks. For this particular disease area, we worked with several advocacy groups. This is very rich with strong voices from patients. And so we listened to a lot of people, but it was also helpful in a way that the focus for our patients, as Tony said, was like, could we just get to non-invasive tests? Like that is, we see that as the biggest problem. And I think most patients kind of agreed on that. So it made for the researchers, it made the job easy. Now, science is about new discovery, and so everybody gets excited about newer ways of treating. But, we sort of, I think, listened and focused on what was the need of the community instead of working on the next frontier, right? These biomarkers have existed for a very long time, but we can't use them. Why not, mm-hmm. right? Let's solve for that. And I think we've incorporated that sentiment and that voice from our patient advocates across multiple nonprofits, and actual voices to make sure that we are addressing the right question.
Right.
And not the question that, oftentimes as scientists, we're guilty of going after what is new and exciting and finding new things, new ways to solve problems. But then there are hurdles that, you can have many new discoveries, but they don't really make it and they don't really help anyone. And mm-hmm. so that's how I think personally, having, been part of this program for about 5 years now, I think that's what we were listening for. And we went to, several advocacy groups that were involved. Through our colleagues at FDA, we got some patient perspectives as well. But then just talking to people has been important, and listening.
And I think incorporating the patient voice is essential. I mean, it's about the patient. It's
at the end of the day.
You're supposed to be helping the patient. So I I think I've seen, we started our nonprofit about 5 years ago, and I can see, and I think there's been a lot more receptivity to incorporating the patient voice into processes like this. And certainly the foundation has done a great job of that. And we're very much appreciative of that. But I think, we just need to be a part of the process, because it's about us. So we need to be, not sitting in the back seat, hoping things happen, but being involved in the driving.
Right. And I think with groups like yours, Tony, I think serve as a catalyst, right, for bringing patients together as well, because having a disease like this can be very isolating. So I think that's also, community building and all of that comes with groups like this. I think it's really important. And then identifying the issues and communicating that with the researchers and scientists, and what better, way to actually get those innovations that will make an impact.
Yes.
Yeah. And finally, what's the future of NAFLD and NASH in terms of future advancements, in terms of, again, the unmet needs and where you think you see things going?
So first, this is a fast evolving space. In the last few months, we have also seen a change in the nomenclature. So I just want to mention that on this podcast as we're discussing. So NAFLD, which used to be non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, is now called MASLD, or metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, it's hard to say. but the idea was to, there's a scientific reason, which is, you know, it's everything is not alcoholic. It's primarily metabolic, right? It's not right. driven by the alcohol, but the non-alcoholic term makes it seem like there's no alcohol involved at all. Mm-hmm. Then really what it is biologically is a metabolic dysfunction. Yeah. So there have been some discussions and there are good arguments on both sides of whether this name change should happen or not. But for now, the various organizations, professional organizations in the US and in Europe have agreed that this is a new nomenclature. So you will be seeing MASLD instead of NAFLD and MASH instead of NASH. And to say that. That's already a big change.
That's a big change indeed, right.
But I think, you know, we continue, this is a very rich field, as you've said, you've covered it a lot, you know all the work that's happening in NASH and NAFLD. Many, many companies are involved. The NIH is actively involved in studying the disease and funding research in this space, and advocacy groups are also involved. So we are all very keenly working towards this change. So there's lots of new biomarkers that have come out even since we started the study. And so they all need to go through similar kind of rigor and testing. But as Tony said, once you can cross that hurdle once, you can have a roadmap for future biomarkers to enter that space. And so there are interesting omics-based biomarkers, which take even mm-hmm. less blood, I think. There are other types of imaging biomarkers, which we haven't been talked right. about today, but that's the other half of the NIMBLE study is, you know, you can image the whole liver using ultrasound or MRI technologies, and they are very good at predicting how the liver looks and how healthy it is and how it's going to progress. So all of those new things are going to come up, but what would be really good to see is if we can find a way to continue to get these biomarkers qualified to get to a yeah. place where we no longer need biopsies. So that would be our ultimate goal, and I don't think we take our eye off that prize. Mm-hmm. We just keep doing the work in the middle that's necessary to build that that evidence base.
Yes, far as going forward for a group like NASH Knowledge, this nomenclature change that Tanya mentioned, it really kind of complicates our life, actually. In the sense that everybody is not going to adapt these changes mm-hmm. at the same time. So, you know, some doctors I know have already adopted the changes. You know, others are dragging their feet and, you know, and are in no rush to implement it. So when we go out talk to the general public, it mm-hmm. presents an issue for us. You know, what do we call it? Because, you know, when they talk to their doctor may call it something different than what we do. So we have taken, I mean, the approach we're taking is kind of a nomenclature neutral approach where we're going to, a lot of the work we do is with the general public. And we're going to describe it more in, you know, in plain English terms, you know, calling it fatty liver, for example. Mm-hmm. But that's a challenge for us going forward. But we continue, just to get out there, you know, feet on the street and talk to people about the disease, you know, raise awareness and get put them in a position, you know, to take advantage of these non-invasive tests.
Tony and I have been talking about this as well, and I think what his point is really important because we already are challenged with awareness. Mm-hmm. And then if you name changes don't quite always help with that. So one of the other things that NIMBLE is doing is to at least do the bridge between the two, right. You know, the description of the disease as NAFLD versus MASLD and NASH versus MASH. Are they about the same? You know, would we have looked at this in a different way if you mm-hmm. had a different set of factors to qualify something? So we're trying to provide that bridge, if you will, between mm-hmm. the existing nomenclature and the new evolving one. And I'm completely supportive of Tony and what he says makes a lot of sense. I think it's difficult to describe things and then already hard enough. And then we add
a wrinkle
to it. But hopefully we can work together as a community to get to the to the other end of this.
Yeah, hopefully it's just a little bump in that transition, but I think the end goal remains the same, no matter what it's called. And I think you both are doing such excellent and such important work in the field. So I'm so happy that I had the chance to speak to the both of you, and I'm sure our audiences took a lot away from this conversation as well. So I'd like to thank you both once again for your time and for continuing to do the great work that you're doing in the field.
Well, thank you. We appreciate the interest. All this discussion elevates, elevates liver health in people's minds, and that's very important.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you very much once again to our guests, Dr. Camphouse and Tony, for being on the show today. Once again, we greatly appreciate your time. That's the end of this episode of the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. If you liked today's show, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Thank you, everyone, and see you next week. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. If you enjoyed our discussions today, please share the episode with your friends and colleagues, and be sure to subscribe in order to be notified when a new episode is released. To join in on the discussion, you can find X-Talks on social media. Email podcast@xtalks.com or comment on the articles directly. Links are in the show description. Take a moment to join our community at xtalks.com to get access to everything we have to offer, including webinars, job listings, virtual meetings, articles, and more. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast are those of the speakers sharing them. They should not be taken as professional advice and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position Honeycomb Worldwide. For further information, email us at podcast@xtalks.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.